Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. I hope everybody had a wonderful, wonderful weekend. I'm back in my sound fort here. I just finished setting it back up after a fun but busy weekend. Got my coffee, and we are good to go. I am not doing yet the follow-up to the Bitcoin threat model and the human threat model. If you haven't listened to those, I haven't posted any of those episodes on the actual website yet, because I actually just went through, finished up my spreadsheet. Took me like 4 or 5 hours on Saturday, finishing up my spreadsheet with all the new source links and all that good stuff for past episodes, and I didn't even think about it when I deleted my Podbean account or deleted the links in it, because I had to have like less than 5 episodes, I think, to revert back to a free account, and killed all of my links in the playlist. And maybe I did realize it at some point, and then just it slipped my mind. But that whole playlist, except for like the last 4 episodes, doesn't play. It just skips over them because time's out. There's no link to those anymore. So I had to go through the short code and update every one of those, also added a couple of additional episodes. We didn't have the Reckless to Wombology episode about the Lightning Network and all that good stuff. And I also want to have not only the playlist, like the full playlist, but also just a list of episodes so that you can go through and just kind of click and view any particular episodes you want about the Lightning Network. So hopefully I'll have that. I mean, that's definitely finally back rolling again. Like, I'm getting stuff done there. But today I want to hit one that I've been talking about hitting for like 3 weeks now. And finally, it was 20 days ago, and I sent Jason. Jason Smith is the name at I Wear a Hoodie. That's his tag on Twitter, and he had a great short little read. It was just a little tweet storm of 5 things that he learned after a year of being seriously into Bitcoin. And I thought there was a bunch of great stuff in here, and I wanted to hit this one on the show because if you missed it, he didn't have a massive number of followers, so it's one of those ones that could slip under the radar, and it was a great, great little tweet storm there. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump right into this, and we will get a little bit of chatting afterward, and I'll give you an update on some other stuff that we have going on in the crypto economy life. All right, guys, let's jump into 5 Things I've Learned After a Year of Being Seriously into Bitcoin by Jason Smith. 1. There is little correlation between early adopters and intelligence. It seems to me that many OGs didn't realize the incredible thing they were sitting on and either rage quit when they didn't get their own way, forked a new coin just to get some random feature they thought everyone needed, or sold their coins early, thinking Bitcoin had hit the top. Many just got offered buckets of cash to go shill or work on shitcoins. Most OGs were just lucky, not smart. That said, the OGs who still understand what Bitcoin is at this point are battle-tested enough to be worth listening to. 2. It's not clear what Bitcoin is exactly. Metaphors abound, but just like there was really nothing to liken the internet to, and we now understand it as its own phenomenon, I think Bitcoin will eventually be seen like that. Yes, it's a bit like gold. Yes, it's like money. But there's something else about it. Civilization as we know it has not seen the free market decide an artificial good is money. overweight bankers writing essays on how it's going to play out are quite frankly embarrassing themselves. 3. Very few people understand how scarce Bitcoin is. VCs who like to sound smart, they are smart to be honest, often say the breakthrough in Bitcoin is digital scarcity, as if to say we have scarcity in the real world, but now we have digital scarcity. No, that's wrong. We have never had scarcity of anything until now. Oh, but there's only one Mona Lisa. True, but there's infinite canvases, paint, and talented artists who will make more. And no one plans to use Mona Lisa as money. Gold? There are untold tons of gold beneath our feet. And every year we get more efficient and automated at digging it up. There are entire continents that we haven't scratched the surface of that are full of gold. Oil? We can grow it. Food? We throw out more food than we can eat. In 30 years, the daily issuance of Bitcoin will be just over 7 coins per day. It's currently 1,800 new coins per day. It will make gold seem hyperinflationary, and when they're all mined, that's it. What other commodity on this earth have humans ever stopped being able to create? 4. Bitcoin is already money. I know everyone who's trying to shill Bitcoin to Wall Street likes to pretend the dark web disappeared when Silk Road closed, but it didn't. It's roaring along, and guess what their currency is? It's Bitcoin. It's not uncommon to see sellers on Dream Market explicitly saying, no Bcash, and they don't even pretend to be interested in receiving BSV, or Bitcoin Satoshi's Vision, or the latest shitcoin. They want Bitcoin. They, many of them at least, know how to stay anonymous with Bitcoin. This is money to them. They're not trying to switch back to USD each day. And there's plenty of folks in other markets keen to receive Bitcoin. A popular buy and sell app here in Oss is called Gumtree. A quick search for Bitcoin on there reveals hundreds, if not thousands, of listings of people willing to accept Bitcoin as payment for their items. And this is despite the decline in the Bitcoin exchange rate last year. No one is waiting for Bitcoin to be blessed with an ETF. No one needs Bakkt to come into town and hold their hands with this thing. We're using it today. The best thing I ever bought with Bitcoin was some cigars. I still have some of them. I was able to pay a seller overseas who only accepted Bitcoin and who would have presumably had a major hassle trying to deal with the government-regulated banking system. 5. Bitcoin appeals to those on the right, but it should appeal to those on the left far more. Finally, we have a tool that will stop the most vulnerable in our communities from having what small income they can acquire stolen through inflation. In the future, no matter how poor you find yourself, whatever job you can do, if you can save some small amount in the form of Bitcoin Satoshis, you have a chance at getting into the property market, investing in an income-generating asset, or simply having something of value to leave to your children. If the super rich spend their Bitcoin, this will spread the coins throughout the economy and create jobs. If they hoard their coins, it simply makes everyone else's Bitcoin more valuable. There's a no-lose situation with the wider community with respect to what the super rich do with their Bitcoin. The same can't be said with today's system. When large institutions borrow billions, they're rich and they dilute my money and make me poorer. This forces me to keep working for them so I can stay on the treadmill of this moronic rat race. If I try and save for a home, I live in constant fear that prices will rise quicker than I can save. So, I'm encouraged to go into debt, which increases the money supply, which dilutes the value of everyone's money, which pushes prices up, which encourages you to borrow, which increases the money supply, etc., etc. If people could store their wealth in money, they wouldn't spend so much of it on real estate, which would reduce speculative demand for houses, which frees up stock and reduces prices for people who want to buy a home to live in. This reduces homelessness, encourages savings, and helps break poverty cycles. I currently work with and next to some of the most vulnerable and desperate people in the community. They live 1 month away from homelessness most of their lives. I love these people. I want to help them. That is why I will support Bitcoin until it is the global reserve currency. That is why I hate altcoins and cryptocurrency scammers and ICOs and pump and dump VCs and everyone else in this space trying to rent seek off the back of Bitcoin. And those are the five things Jason Smith has learned after a year of being seriously into Bitcoin. All right, so I got a lot to talk about in this one, but before we jump into it, let's go ahead and talk about our sponsor, and then we will discuss this at length. And they are all critical lessons that I think everybody pretty much has to learn if they actually stick around in Bitcoin. The absolute most important being the economic reality. We have so many common fallacies and misunderstandings and just total and complete ignorance about money as a society. At least I'm coming at this from a perspective of the average person in the U.S. here. But it's pretty widespread. It's not like, you know, you would talk to somebody in the U.K. and they'd have some vast depth in understanding what money is and what sound money is versus fiat money. It's pretty much widespread that it's just not taught. And that's one of the most powerful things about Bitcoin to me is that it forces you to look at that. Like more people, I think, have learned I think Bitcoin has forced more people to learn about money than anything else I could possibly imagine. I could not even come close to naming anything that has had the impact on the debate and the ideology around money that Bitcoin has opened up. And it forces people who believe in the Keynesian or mainstream cartoonish idea that we just print to get what we want, it's forced them to defend their argument, which they've never had to do. It's just always been the default. And that just changing that frame is alone enough to change the game. And it's just, it's such an exciting thing because you didn't have debates about it before. Like that was one of the biggest problems when my brother and I were deep into economics and talking about this stuff, is really just finding sources, like finding different ideas and stuff to test. It was almost like Hayek and Rothbard and Hans Hermann Hoppe. It's almost like these people didn't exist. And it took serious searching. And when you would hear some of their subtle arguments and you hear that it's so funny, the main difference between, that's a quick read I actually wanted to get to. I'm sure I've got that somewhere in my links. But that the core difference between Austrian and Keynesian economics is that Keynesian economic theory has no valuation of time. It doesn't take into account at all the fact that spending money today is more valuable than spending money in 3 weeks. Having the production of your labor immediately versus having to wait for it, there's a cost for that. It's called the interest rate, and it should be a market price. And it's almost non-existent in the Keynesian theory, outside of the fact that it's just supposed to be manipulated to, you know, essentially get whatever you want with it. And there's this amazing set of principles and theories about what the value of time is and how it affects. And it's intuitive, you know, like it's amazing. It makes economics interesting. And it reveals the unbelievable power, the both horribly negative and positive effects of manipulating or of the changes in the time value of money, of you know, issuing. It makes inflation, the true nature of inflation, clear. And when you come at it from first principles, when you look that money is not a resource, money is an allocation mechanism. Money is essentially a spreadsheet for dividing up real things and real value that we have. So if you're just manipulating the spreadsheet, all you're doing is unfairly adjusting or reallocating real world resources into the hands of people with a short-term mindset and who make poor long-term decisions, and taking it out of the hands of people who are trying to make smart, frugal, long-term trade-offs, and essentially punishing them for it. That's why sound money defeats poverty. That's how it works to eliminate the major struggles for the people at the very bottom of the totem pole. It gives them the ability to, even with a tiny fraction of the labor they're producing, they're not constantly catching up. They don't have to constantly fight for a higher wage. I mean, you think about that. Who would ever have to raise the minimum wage in a sound money system? It would already be worth more the next year. On top of the fact that the standard of living, the default level of standard of living, would be increasing because of the increased productivity of society. And then the people who are actually producing, the people making the long-term decisions, the people who are being frugal and not wasting resources, not consuming it for no reason at all, would be the beneficiaries. So you would be rewarded for being efficient, for lowering the prices of goods that other people need. If I don't need these extra resources, if I don't need this house to live in, then like if I'm not needing something to directly consume it, then it doesn't benefit me to take, it doesn't benefit anyone to remove that resource from the availability of someone else who needs it more than me, just because I'm trying to keep from having to lose value in the money. The money is the resource that isn't important. It's the resource that doesn't, it's the thing that people don't eat. You know, you don't eat money. You don't live in money. You don't build with money. The money is the allocation of other resources. If you destroy the value of money, you have people scrambling to scoop up all the resources and make it unavailable to the people who really need it, or raise the price for the people who really need it, because you're just trying to keep from losing the labor that you made yesterday. The whole point of money is so that I can work today. What makes it a powerful tool is that I can work today and be given a tally sheet, essentially, of this is the work you did. You'll be able to consume this amount of work a little bit down the road. Like, you can wait for 3 weeks and then exchange it. You don't have to have the immediate coincidence of wants. You don't have to find somebody who immediately wants your exact labor and skill for the exact labor and skill or resource that you need. I don't have to go to the store and like figure out what somebody wants at that moment to get a sandwich for them. You know, I don't have to go into Starbucks and be like, you know, do you need me to fix your Wi-Fi? Because I'll do that in exchange for a sandwich. I mean, what do I do if they're not having Wi-Fi problems? Like, they don't need that. It's like, okay, well, what do you want? You want a back massage? What do you need right in this very moment? It's like, I don't need anything. It's like, well, then I can't buy a sandwich. Money is merely the tool to bridge that gap. So I can fix somebody's computer or networking issues today, and 6 weeks later, that labor still buys me a sandwich, even though nobody at that immediate time, or the person that needed help with their computer, they didn't need a sandwich. They just ate lunch, you know? Money is a tool to translate time. The fact that Keynesian theory literally has no way to value time in their theories, like in their framework of economics is almost alone. It's alone. If you consider nothing else about Keynesian economics, it has no way to value or understand the cost of time. And time is without question one of our most valuable and limited resources. So that alone should pretty much discredit the entire school of thought. I've got a number of other episodes about economics and money on the show that I'm putting together. That might be the next playlist and collection that I release. So that's one to keep an ear out for if you're interested in that kind of stuff, because that was these are kind of the principles and debates that led me to Bitcoin in the first place. It was from a position of trying to learn about economics and being exposed to the Austrian theory that just blew my mind. And I was immediately like, I was coming at it from that perspective when I first heard of Bitcoin. And that's what immediately appealed to me about it was the ability to digitally, as a nerd, I saw no resistance to the fact that it was digital. And, but the fact that it was essentially an experiment in the Austrian theory was just like this could either prove or disprove in an actual real world market environment, essentially their theories. And that was fascinating to me. That's why I was on it the second I heard about it. I hit it from that perspective, and there was nothing else that could come close to being a real-world experiment of Austrian theory as Bitcoin was at the time for me. And inflation of the money supply is so deeply tied to that. Like one perspective that I heard that has stuck with me, because it's such a simple flipping of the narrative, that you hear inflation encourages people to invest in businesses or in productive assets or whatever. Like, you know, without inflation, everybody would just hoard money. And it's like, well, okay, well, let's flip that on its head. With inflation, that means that with inflation, people will hoard actual resources. Like, they'll hoard scarce resources. I mean, the claim is that hoarding is part of human nature and that you're going to inflate the money supply and people will, so that people aren't hoarding money, you're not going to change the nature of people. You're not going to get people to stop giving a shit about their future and wanting life to be better next week than it is this week. They're not going to stop that. You're not going to just say it's like, oh, you know, hoarding is no longer, we're going to make hoarding money no longer profitable. And by the way, don't hoard anything else. No, if you inflate the money supply, you just have them hoard something else. Money isn't a resource. Money isn't food. Money isn't something that is consumed when you use it. It's a way to take labor from today and, like, I will produce production. I provide production into the economic pool of resources today, and I am allowed to consume that same amount of value at a later date. That's it. That's what money does. So to say that like inflation encourages me to invest in, you know, productive assets or in the stock market or in actual resources just means that I'm now just hoarding something that is actually usable. Like I'm hoarding and raising the price of food by buying commodities, or I'm hoarding and raising the price of housing by buying a house to keep the value of my money and just sitting on it so that I can sell it in 3 years. So like he says in this, in number five, I'm raising the price. I'm going into debt to raise the price of housing, keeping people from being unable to afford housing if they don't have much money. And all the while, they're fighting and screaming just to get a pay raise because it's worth less than it was last year. Inflation, particularly core inflation from a centralized institution that has the sole monopoly right to inflate a currency, is merely a form of subtle, hidden slavery. It means that to the degree that they counterfeit money, your labor is going to what they wish it to go to. Your labor is funding their projects, their goals, and their selfish desires. They are able to unilaterally confiscate the value and the time of other people's labor to impose, to economically impose their vision of the world. And they do it without trading, without cooperating, or without the explicit consent of anyone that they are taking the value from. I don't really know what else to call that other than slavery. Like, if you're calling it what it is, like, that's what it is. All right, I went off the rails with point five. I shouldn't have started there. lots of stuff on economics, and I'm going to hit another one on economics soon, so keep an ear out for that one. We'll hit that from, for people who aren't introduced to that idea, that might be a little bit, too far down the rabbit hole, but, you know, we'll see. I think it's important to hit those ideas, and economics is such a fascinating thing to me. I can't believe people think that's boring, all right, let's head back to point one really quick, because I do have a couple of short comments about the other ones in this as well. Little correlation between early adopters and intelligence. Absolutely. There are just as many, or probably more, OGs who got into it early who just dropped out because they thought the gig was up. I mean, after that first major, not the crash between from like $1 to 10 cent or 8 cent, whatever it was, but shortly thereafter, the crash from $30 to like $1.20 or something like that. I can't remember exactly how low it got. It was terrible. That's the drop that made me throw up. There were just as many, I mean, there were so many people who, huge, huge swaths of the community were just like, peace, I'm out of here. This gig is up. That was fun. I'm out. I had a friend who bought a mining rig with a bunch of GPUs for practically, you know, a third of what it actually cost. And they had a little debate when that person came over and it's like, nah, dude, Bitcoin's done. He was like, what? It's like we just had a big price bubble. And he was like, nah, it's done. It's like, no, it's not. He's like, I mean, he's trying to tell the person who is buying his mining rig that his mining rig wasn't worth anything. He should have really like tried to talk him down the price. He's like, oh, this isn't worth anything. Well, maybe I'll give you 20% less than you're asking for. Plenty of OGs had no idea what they'd stumbled upon. And I know that from personal experience. Many people I've talked to, the number of people who told me that, oh, you're an idiot for staying in this thing. I was like, all right, you know, fine. I get that you feel that way, but the price isn't the technology. The price is mentality. The price is emotion. So if you're going by its value, it's been, you know, 3 months. 3 months. The price was this. Now it's one-tenth of this. Technology hasn't changed one wink. Monetary policy hasn't changed at all. Nothing else has changed. All the fundamentals are exactly the same, but you believed in it when the price was this, but now you don't because the price is this. Well, you didn't believe in it for anything other than the price. Like you had no understanding of what it was. And that's very common, and it happens it has happened to a huge degree every single bull run and bear market. And it will continue to happen. Two, it's not clear what Bitcoin is exactly. Metaphors abound, but it's pretty much like the internet. You know, we don't understand it, but we realize that it's going to be something in and of itself, like in its own. And that's absolutely true. I think as Jameson Lopp said, you can't understand Bitcoin. Nobody understands Bitcoin. And the longer you're in Bitcoin, the more you realize you don't understand it. And that's absolutely true. I think, without a doubt, like in my mind, I was more convinced, I was more set on what I thought Bitcoin was, like, you know, within a couple of weeks, thinking I'd done my research and figured it out. And then the more I read and the more I learned, the more I was like, man, you know, this thing is so much deeper and it can have so much more impact even than I thought then, and I was completely engrossed in it already. And it's, I mean, I've had to change my view of what Bitcoin was multiple times now. And it's all been around the same principles, you know, like it's the same fundamental reasons that I'm trying to assess what it could be or why it's valuable. But it's very easy to experience like a minor change in your frame of reference or your perspective and realize that, oh my God, there's a whole layer here that I hadn't quite seen the first time around. And at this point, I fully expect to, in a year, I fully expect to have a still very different view of what Bitcoin is and how this thing is going to play out than I do today. I will look back and think and hopefully be happy with some of the pieces that I saw that were right and probably be embarrassed by some of the ideas that I had that were just wrong. And that's both, I think, for Lightning and Bitcoin. So that's one thing to always keep in mind that, you know, economics is the great myth buster. If your vision of it doesn't turn out, you should look at it again and try to put the sunglasses on to see it through a different viewpoint and just drop your entire image of what Bitcoin is and look at it as it is from that day with none of that prior bias and see if you can decide what makes it valuable. Why is it still around? Why are we on another bull run this time around? Is it really for the reasons that I thought last year? I mean, like you said, civilization has not seen the free market decide an artificial good as money. We've never seen this in the real world. This is one of the greatest economic experiments ever. And people dismissing it, I'm missing one of the greatest revolutions that I could, like, I think it's only, it's like people who just talk about how the internet is bad and that, you know, oh, Twitter is toxic. It's like, well, so, like, the look at the difference. Look at the frame of reference that you're comparing it to 20 years ago. It's like, okay, yeah, you might get in an echo chamber, but that's a completely, that's a wholly different plateau of problem is to end up in an echo chamber on the internet than it was to have three different television channels to choose from that all gave you different colors of the exact same opinion. There are just so many fundamental changes happening, and people who want to focus on the tiny, you know, people who want to focus on the new problems forget that we just solved eight other ones. And scarcity, number three. People do not understand how scarce Bitcoin is. This one, when I was reading it, this was really the point that made me go, damn, that's so true. Because you don't really think about it. But there really isn't anything. I kind of went down, like I was sitting here and I just was looking at these tweets. And I was thinking, I was trying to go through my head anything that was truly that scarce. That scarce and that sound. Because one of the key things about Bitcoin is that it's trustless to the degree that you're not trusting. It's not some other human specifically that you're trusting with a promise of something, a promise of some commodity or the promise of some production. If you're talking about a stock or a commodity that somebody else is holding for you and you got the digital ticket that lets you go to the counter and get it from them. And I don't know, you can think for hours and I just can't think of anything. Anything real in the world that we just can't make. There's no commodity that we can't get more of. There's essentially an endless, even regardless of the degree of cost, there's essentially an endless supply of any commodity and resource that we want. It's just a matter of, it might cost a monumental amount of money to go get it somewhere. But even with high cost, even with the unforgeable costliness of Bitcoin, it doesn't even matter. It's not strictly that, oh, it's just going to cost a lot. Like, you just won't be able to make any more of it. It gets more costly to create, and there's a absolute strict amount that you'll ever be able to get regardless. It's not like we can discover a new planet and it's got a bunch of Bitcoin on it. Like, we could do that with gold or any resource that we have. And that just doesn't exist. That doesn't exist in Bitcoin. Or excuse me, that doesn't exist. What Bitcoin is to scarcity, I don't know. I can't think of anything. All right. And then lastly, number four, Bitcoin is already money. There is an economy that is circular in the Bitcoin world that trades in and out of Bitcoin with production and the dark web. And the dark, like he says, the dark web is alive and well. It's amazing how many, if anybody keeps up with it, there's a couple websites that just keep up with all the stuff going on in the dark web. And I like to hit it every once in a while just to see the news. Because there's been so many like dark web market shutdowns since the Silk Road. It was pretty regular there for a little bit. In fact, it's kind of surprising that some of the ones that are around today, he mentioned, what was the one? Where is it? It's not okay. Dream Market. He mentions Dream Market. And I think there's another big one that have both been around for a really long time. And the fact that they've survived as long as they have and that there's still a significant market there is just a testament to the fact that, you know, this is censorship-resistant money. You know, like, you can't shut down the financing. Like, they have, there's a black market, and as far as it seems right now, there's not any way to shut it down. And I don't know how anybody would. They're trying. I've spent a lot of resources on trying so far. So it's money today. It might be volatile. Price might be going crazy. But he's right. Bitcoin is money. All right. We'll stop it here. I've gone way too long already. I hope you guys enjoyed that great little tweet storm by Jason Smith at I Wear a Hoodie. Let's see if we can. He's got 967 followers, and with a tweet storm like that, he deserves more. Let's see if we can't get him over 1,000. If you guys are not following Jason Smith at I Wear a Hoodie on Twitter, check him out. I will link to the tweet storm and just the regular Twitter account. Go follow him on Twitter. I've followed him ever since. I didn't know about him until this tweet storm. But I'm going to bet that he's going to have a lot more great stuff to have in the future. Guy has learned some amazingly serious lessons about Bitcoin and the real philosophy and principles behind it in his first year. So there's undoubtedly there's more to come here. And thank you, Jason, for if that is your actual name. But thank you for letting me read this and discuss this on the show. Really love that short little tweet storm and hope to see more in the future. All right, guys. Oh, let's go ahead and close this one out. This is the Crypto Economy Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. Drop me a review on iTunes. Help get this show out to people. Share this to all the other people in the crypto economy space. For those who want to hear all the best discussion, debate, and writings, all the articles in the Bitcoin economy and Bitcoin space, this is where they're going to get it. The Crypto Economy Podcast. And I got some other fun stuff coming up. I've got an interview that I've got scheduled for tonight, and we'll have that on the show. I think it's going to be a fun one. So stick with me. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to share and check out cryptoeconomy.life, where I will be posting all of this awesome stuff. And I'll have that playlist and page on economics soon, hopefully. I'll keep you up to date when I get that out. All right, guys. Thank you for listening, and I will catch you next time on the show. Until then, take it easy, guys. We'll be right back.